Hey folks, we have some exciting news to tell y'all about. The Bad Rollin' Project has partnered with Expedition 44 and Rival Nations to start the one-of-a-kind No Key But Christ Network. This network will consist of content creators with the focus of Jesus as King and no other. For more information, visit NoKeyButChristNetwork.com. Now back to the show.
Welcome to the Bad Roman Podcast. On this show, we talk with veterans, community leaders, Christians, and non-Christians as we explore the entanglement of Christians with the state. The Bad Roman Project was created out of the firm belief that as Christians, we are called to follow Christ, not the state. Here is your host, Craig Hargis.
Hey, folks. Today, Michael Corbell joins me, and we're going to discuss his article that he wrote for thebadroman.com titled, Against Those Who Are Against the State, and also talk to him about his own podcast, The Invictus Mind. Michael was a gracious host when he had me on to talk about the Bad Roman Project, and I have been looking forward to having him on our show as well. I really enjoyed our conversation and also have a ton of respect for his work and him as a person.
Let's go. Right. We'd rather serve God than serve right. Caesar, you feel me?
Right. I'm just trying to live what he said. I'm just trying to live.
Michael, how are you doing today?
Doing great, Craig. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. Just hanging in there. Just another day, one day at a time, I guess. But before we get started, why don't you give us a little background on yourself?
Well, I am actually an entrepreneur and a podcaster. I spent about 15 years of my life as a financial advisor. And what that means is I sit down with clients and I figure out how to get them out of debt, how to invest in the future, things like retirement planning, emergency fund savings. And I kind of gotten out of that as a full-time job. I still have a handful of clients, and I've been focusing more on just building a business via online and doing some podcasting.
How's that working? You staying pretty busy?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm getting some good guests on a podcast, and I've spent a lot of time learning about internet marketing and affiliate marketing over the last year as everyone shut in because of COVID-19. I said, well, I'm not going to just sit around and complain. I'm going to actually develop my skill set and learn more about this technology that I've kind of wasted most of my life not learning about. So now I think I'm caught up to speed for the most part.
So at the time of this recording, it's towards the end of March, but are you seeing like this COVID stuff? Are you starting to notice it's kind of go away in your area? Are people still acting like they have been over the past year, or is it kind of starting to fade away a little bit?
Well, I think that the compliance to the mask mandates is just as bad as it's ever been. I'm probably one of only 2 or 3% of people who do not wear masks in my neighborhood. There's like a 97% compliance factor here. But I don't really know how many people are getting sick or whatnot, because I don't really pay attention to that anymore. I just live my life. I told my wife to stop worrying about COVID and just live life, because I think that's the main cure to everything.
Right. I agree. I was just curious because since I've moved a little further away from Memphis, and Memphis is still pretty, you know, being Memphis, but it's a little different out here where I'm at now in Oakland. But there's still some, you know, still running around. I was in the post office the other day and I got thrown out because I wouldn't wear a mask, and I'd already cleared it with the postmaster that I could come in and grab my mail and wouldn't be a problem. But the guy in there, I like to call him a little tiny tyrant, was being pretty rude about it. And he already knew the situation. So I finally just had to get back on the phone with the postmaster. And now they just bring the mail out to me because they're just now getting mailboxes set up out here at our neighborhood. So that's been a nightmare and a pain to deal with.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of restaurants that let you sit down inside, but they still make you wear a mask at the door. And I just don't even go to those restaurants because that illogical action of walking through the door with a mask on and sitting down, it doesn't make any sense and it irritates me. So there's a handful of restaurants that I go to that they don't require anything. They just, you know, come and go. But people still choose to wear the mask. And I never have a problem with them choosing that. But as long as people don't harass me, I'm good with it.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious. I've been seeing that, too, with some restaurants. I think I've been kind of following Texas since they ended the mask mandates down there, and especially Dallas area. They're really, a lot of the restaurants are still making people wear masks. I'm really kind of curious if this would be kind of a good case study for how the free market might actually work. Are people going to choose to go to certain restaurants depending on masks and this and that, and how those businesses will survive with that as well. It's going to be interesting to watch.
Well, my wife is a waitress at a restaurant, and one of the reasons why a lot of the restaurants are scared about this is because the health inspector will come every once in a while, make an appearance, and I guess they can get fined if they see somebody who's not mask compliant at the entrance of the place. Luckily, my wife's boss, the owner of that restaurant, doesn't care about that, but a lot of these people are just a little concerned about what the government can do. Although the sheriffs are not enforcing them in our county.
See, that's what I was going to ask. So y'all still have the mandates up there, but they're not being enforced. And I mean, when you can't enforce these stupid mandates, how are they going to get away with them anyway? It doesn't make any sense. And they're just relying on the public still, I think.
We've been in phase four for like 6 months, which I don't even know what that means. But phase five is supposed to be you get your freedoms back.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for phase five. Phase five may never come. It's probably, I hate the term the new normal. I'm so sick of hearing that. I heard that so much when this started that I just, anytime I hear that, you know, really grinds my gears. I'm like, no, it might be your new normal, but it's not mine. I'm not going to walk around with this diaper on my face because you're afraid of getting sick. It doesn't make any sense to me. But that being said, I think we released some frustration on each other a little bit. So in your article, and I'm not going to pretend to know how to pronounce the subject of your article. Tell me what that word, what is that word? How do you say that first?
Well, it's a silly word that was made up in the 19th century. It says anti-disestablishmentarianism.
Say that one more time.
Anti-disestablishmentarianism.
Okay. Okay. All right. I don't know if it's something you can say three times. I'm going to hold you to two, though, right there. So tell me a little bit about what that means.
Well, I wrote the article because obviously I like your podcast, Craig, and I've read some of the other articles. I've interviewed Abby Kleckner on your show. And I just remember that word. My dad told me that word a long time ago is one of the longest words in the English language. And so I think what got me involved in wanting to write about that word was I had a conversation with my daughter just about words in general. And she's like, what's one of the longest words that you know about? And so I said, I'll say it a third time for you, Craig, anti-disestablishmentarianism. And so as I was thinking about that word, I was breaking it down and I wanted to know what it actually meant. And so, you know, I did the research on it and it actually, well, we'll get into it, but it means against those who are against the status quo. So it's kind of a contrarian type of word against people with the liberty mindset.
So it's against folks like us is what you're saying.
Correct.
So is it disestablishmentarianism, not the anti ones? They were doing this trying to separate the church from the state. Am I getting that correct?
Yes, correct. So again, it's just a silly word that I used to write an article about. But basically, you have to break apart the word into different roots. So we can start with the word establishment, right? You and I understand what an establishment is, right? We call it the cathedral as coined by Michael Malice, right? Or we can call it the deep state or the government. That's what the establishment is, right? And so when you actually have an establishment, then you have people who are going to naturally be against the establishment. Now, in my article, I talk about the root of the word Aryan, A-R-I-A-N, and not to be confused with those who are white supremacists, Aryans. Aryan is just a root word in English that means a group of people that follow a similar ideology. So establishmentarians would be those who are in favor of government, those who are in favor of the establishment. Now, the ism is actually, that's a philosophy. So you have an establishment, you have establishmentarian, whose ideology is in favor of the government, and you have a group of them. Okay, so that's establishmentarianism. Now, disestablishment would mean to break it apart. So if I believe that I want to get rid of the establishment or I want to break apart from the establishment, I would be a disestablishmentarian, and my philosophy or my ideology would be disestablishmentarianism. Now, put four letters on top of that, anti-disestablishmentarianism is those who are against the people who are against the establishment, if you follow me.
Yeah, I think I'm with you.
It's not a common word that people use, but I just thought it was clever and it was in the English language. So You know, nobody uses that anymore. I just thought it was a clever word.
I had never heard it. We certainly don't use it down here in the South. I promise you that. It's not something I've ever heard before in my life, and I still don't think I could pronounce it.
It's not really used in America at all. It's more of a word that they, you know, like I said, it was coined in the 19th century in England, and it was used in their publications at the time. But it's still there in the English language. And if you actually go to YouTube, it's known as one of the longest words in the English language that is not a health, like a disease or a health condition.
So how did this start? So in your article, you said the history of this ideology begins with the story of a great schism between or in Christianity. And you were talking about Henry VIII in the year 1533. Tell us a little bit about that and how that is. This is where this word came from. This is how it started.
The word actually came about in the 19th century, but the establishment, going back to King Henry VIII, you might remember in history, King Henry VIII had several wives who were trying to conceive a son to pass on the kingdom of England. And Henry VIII, Catherine of Aragon was his original wife. He fell in love with a second woman named Anne Boleyn. Anne Boleyn was his true love. Catherine of Aragon was his first wife that he wanted to divorce from. And in that time in history, you had to actually seek annulment through the Pope. So you had to go back in history and look at how all these kingdoms and the way that they actually made truces with each other. The kings and queens would marry each other from different countries. So the Roman emperor might have a son or daughter who might marry somebody in England, for example. And so there was all kinds of different ways that they set up the kingdoms. The main theology at that point in time was Roman Catholic. And so the Pope had the ultimate say as to who would be married and who could not be married. The Pope would not grant his divorce because he was afraid of the other king, of the Roman Emperor, Charles V. So this whole thing with Henry VIII, he wanted to actually have a son. His first wife would not let him have a son. He fell in love with another woman named Anne Boleyn, and she could not conceive a son either. So as legend has it, King Henry VIII had like 7 or 8 wives, and he would keep killing these wives because they wouldn't conceive a son, and they didn't know anything about genetics or anything like that and how the chromosomes worked. So they didn't know why he couldn't have a son. So he just blamed the women and either divorced them or killed them. So at that point in time, King Henry VIII, he kind of had this mindset that he was going to ignore the edicts from the emperor and basically say, I'm going to do what I want to do because I'm the king of England, and the heck with this pope over there in Rome. I'm going to come up with my own church. I'm going to create an establishment that is going to have a declaration of we're going to be a church. We're going to call it the Church of England. So the Church of England was established in 1534, which basically meant that everything that the king said was what the religion was. So the divine right of kings came from that thought process. The Church of England was the main theocratic entity then.
Well, next time I have a girlfriend that is upset with me about anything, I'm going to be like, "You, at least I'm not King Henry VIII. You could have had a lot worse than me." Next time I hear any complaints from a woman, I'm going to be like, let me tell you about King Henry VIII. That guy was pretty bad.
Yeah.
So finishing up with that, it was not until the mid-19th century that people started to question this order. Some people wanted to disestablish the Church of England as it was constituted and engage in their own form of faith and religion. But it was unclear if seeking freedom of religion would be possible under the current establishment. You want to go into that a little bit?
Yeah, well, so 1534, you know, that's right when the Enlightenment period of human history started happening. No, it wasn't that far before then. We heard of people like Martin Luther, right? And in his 96 theses, right, that he put on the chapel in Rome. So you had movements like Lutheranism come into play and some of the other major religions. And so the Anglican faith that was the Church of England, we had people who were like thinking, well, I don't think they really follow the scripture the way it should be. They started reading about Martin Luther and some of these other religions. There was no freedom of religion in England at that point in time. If you were going to practice faith, you had to practice in the Church of England. You had to be part of the Anglican faith. You couldn't become Catholic, for example. You couldn't become Lutheran. You couldn't become any number of the Protestant sects that were out there. They were forbidden in the state. And so when these people wanted to create other churches, when they were enlightened and they had other ideas of faith, they decided that they were going to try to break away from the established rule that was in England, from the Church of England.
Are you talking about Chalmers? I'm reading ahead in your article a little bit.
Yeah. So, I mean, Chalmers was one of the top people. He was a Scottish minister. He argued in favor of non-intrusion ideology. He wanted to have a free church to stay away from the government. You know, that when the government and the church are mingled together, then most of their laws are going to be, they're going to be in conjunction. And we know here in America that we don't want any kind of religion to be mixed with government edicts, because then it's a bad situation.
No, sure. Yeah. And you see the entanglement, it seems to be getting worse and worse. Now, you said, and from this thinking comes the long-held conservative belief that the traditions upheld by the 18th and 19th century people of Great Britain and the United States were largely biblically based, and that the laws corresponded to these faith traditions. Do you believe that? Do you believe that the laws of America coincide with, say, the teachings of Christ?
Do I believe the laws of America coincide with the teachings of Christ? That's kind of a loaded question.
Sure it is. That's
right. Yes and no. I mean, you can see good. You can see the good and the bad. I mean, so one common mistake, I think, that a lot of people think about the founding fathers of the United States of America is that they were all Christians. And if you actually study history, they were not all Christians. We had all kinds of faiths, the founding fathers. Thomas Jefferson, for example, was what's known as a deist. Deism basically did not say that there was an actual God, did not accept that Christ was a savior. But to my understanding, deism said there is a higher power. We should probably pay attention to some of the principles that the higher power teaches, but it's not exactly the gospel of Jesus Christ. So the founding fathers, you know, they wanted to create a world where we're going to let people freely practice religion as they see fit, but we're going to create laws that are, you know, keep the public safe. I mean, if you look at the Ten Commandments, I don't have them in front of me, but, you know, thou shalt not kill seems like a good law to have, right? So there's laws against murder, right? Thou shalt not steal is in Ten Commandments. So they created laws about stealing. Now, in other Ten Commandment laws, you know, thou shalt have no other gods before me is a Ten Commandment, but nowhere in the law system of the United States is thou shalt have no other gods before me. I think that's a little different when you compare it to England, right? The king, they saw themselves as almost godlike figures. The divine right of kings is something that the Church of England came up. So if you have, if you are a king, then you are appointed by God, and your law system is based on whatever he says. You know, it came from God. I was appointed to be king by God. So therefore, whatever I say is the law and is holy, because I'm the highest form of government there is besides Jesus Christ himself.
Well, the reason I asked you that, because I don't know if you listened to our episode with Mike Gaddy, we've talked about secession, but I've got him coming back on, and we're going to talk about the Constitution and whether it's a Christian document, because a lot of the right believes that it was somehow God-breathed, that they were following Christ when writing the Constitution. It's not even true, but that's why I asked you that question, just kind of lead into that. But because you said something else interesting in the article, I think it still holds true today, because I've always used to believe that you could legislate morality. That's just not true. But you said something in there, and it said, policies regarding things such as same-sex marriage, drug usage, prostitution, and militant atheism need to be legislated or outlawed by the state. Conservatives believe that without the establishment, morality would cease to exist in society. They do believe that. I mean, because I was one of them. I believe that we could somehow legislate morality when it came to same-sex marriage or stuff like that. And I've told this embarrassing story about myself on Chris Folk's podcast, and we had me and Abby on, that when the Supreme Court struck down same-sex marriage legal, I was convinced that Jesus was coming back at any minute after that. That was it. He wasn't going to stand for this, you know, because we were able to keep people moral by passing a law to get married if they were the same sex. And it's, like I said, it's a very embarrassing story that I tell on myself all the time.
Yeah, well, you know, it's one thing to have a moral standard, right? It's one thing to say, I'm going to live by gospel principles in my own life. And I would hope that other people in my community and especially my family might keep the same standards. Now, does that mean that I want the government coming to throw people in cages because they don't keep my standards? That's where I draw the line, right? I may not morally believe in same-sex marriage, but what I believe for my life and for my family, I don't believe that anybody has a right to say you can't live that way in another type of family arrangement. I don't want people thrown in jail for making decisions on their own. You know, we all have to answer to God individually anyway. You know, there's sins that we commit and there's sins that the sin of omission and the sin of commission, right? So except for the grace of Jesus Christ, nobody is going to be saved. And whether I engage in homosexual activity or I'm just a shoplifter, both are sins in the eyes of the Lord. At least that's my understanding. But I live by a standard of, hey, don't steal other people's stuff. So yeah, there might be some kind of punishment for that. But when people want to have personal relationships, I don't think that that's hurting anybody. It might be, quote unquote, against the gospel principles in the Bible, but why should the state come in here and say you can't do that and throw them in jail?
Well, it's a common question I get from people that just find our podcast, and it is about same-sex marriage. And, you know, I used to, and I heard Shane Claiborne say this. I've got him coming on as well, but I've listened to some of his stuff on some podcasts he's on. He said something, because I used to have a lot of strong opinions about homosexuality, and I didn't even know a gay person. He said, that just doesn't make any sense, you know, and he knew somebody in college that was attracted to the same sex, and he was struggling with it, like God had made a mistake, and he was contemplating suicide. And he's like, if we don't have a place in church for this guy, then what have we become? But anyway, like, I get this question quite a bit from people, and I've gotten to the point now where to me, it's none of my business. I don't think the state should be involved with it, period. They shouldn't be involved with marriage. That's between two people. Same sex or not, that's their business. And I've got enough stuff going on in my own life to worry about what somebody else is doing behind closed doors. It's just not my business. And I take the words of Jesus very seriously when he says to love your neighbor, regardless of what they're doing. And so that's how I approach those questions, because it doesn't make sense for me to worry about it. How can I work on myself and worry about what somebody else is doing? I can't. I'm distracted by that, and I shouldn't even be. I've got enough going on in my own personal life that I need to worry about to worry about somebody else.
You're absolutely correct about that. I mean, like I mentioned before, every single one of us is going to be accountable to God, and we're all sinners because we live in a fallen world. We're not supposed to judge others. It says right there in scriptures, you know, let's judge not, lest you're going to be judged yourself. And so I'm not the arbiter of who gets into heaven, who doesn't. All I know is what I read in the scriptures. Now, people are going to interpret scriptures a million different ways, but as long as I believe and I continue to grow, and I do believe in the repentance process, which is growing and developing and you know, looking at scripture and looking at it different ways, and as long as I'm not affecting another person's individuality, then I think I'll be all right. But again, I got to fall back to the Savior to know where I'd done wrong. So I'm not going to sit there and demand anybody to live the way I want to live, as long as they're not hurting me, right? As long as they're not hurting other people. I'm not going to ask the law to come down on them. I'm not going to ask anybody to say, you can't do that. Because like you said, it's none of your business, none of my business. It was Matt Kibbe, not to take this in a different direction, but Matt Kibbe from a libertarian thinker, he said, don't hurt me, don't take my stuff. That's pretty much the seven words that I live my life by, and it aligns perfectly with the gospel, right? Don't hurt me. Don't take my stuff. You know, so for me to judge anybody else's personal lives doesn't make any sense, because it would be outside of that standard right there.
Right, right. Completely agree. All right, let's get back to the article. I was going to say something. Let's pick on the left a little bit. We just picked on the right a little bit, so let's pick on the left now. All right, so it says, those on the left who call themselves religious see the biblical commandment for charity to be something that must be orchestrated by the government. They often invoke the welfare clause from Article 1, Section 8 of the U.S. Constitution as a reason to tax and redistribute money to those they deem to be in need or underprivileged. They ridicule people who oppose state-sponsored charities and claim moral superiority to those who feel that private organizations could do a job better. Liberal establishments want to use government to force people to act in a way they feel God has called people to behave. They supersede the council, that was given by church authorities and demand that power be placed in the hands of civil government. And that is so true. And that the whole, the welfare clause in Article 1, Section 8, that drives me crazy. I mean, when I first started studying the Constitution, and I had to pinpoint the welfare clause and learn what that actually meant, because it does not mean what the left wants you to think it means. You got to go back to like the Federalist Papers to read like what James Madison said about it. I mean, when you show that to them, then they'll go into something else. They'll either try and argue, or keep arguing in ignorance, or they'll just change the subject altogether. Do you got anything you want to add to that? Because I see that with the left thinks that they can force people through the state to act a certain way, just like the right thinks they can use the state to force people to act a certain way.
Well, you have to think about it this way. When, even if we're going to use the Constitution as an argument, and that could be a whole other discussion as to whether there's any legitimacy behind the Constitution. But if you were going to use that as a legitimate governing document, the welfare clause was written before the 16th Amendment, which established the tax system that we have right now. The 16th Amendment was, I don't remember exactly when it was passed. I think that was 1913. The 16th and the 17th were both passed. And so we're talking 120 years of U.S. history before they even were able to tax people on their income, not to mention all the other ways that they get our money, right? You and I probably both agree that taxation is theft. And so, you know, what did they mean by welfare versus, okay, I'm going to steal your money today because I have an amendment that says that, you know, you owe us tax money and we're going to pay for all these things that they're not even accountable to what they take our money for and all these other different types of welfare systems they have.
Hey folks, Craig here, and I'd like to let y'all know we are always looking for writers to contribute to our blog. I don't care if you have any experience or not. Two or three of our contributors had no prior experience writing, and it turns out they have a real knack for it. Our project coordinator helps them put the articles together, and she publishes them on our website and Facebook page, and you will also have the option to come on the show and go more in depth about your article. So if you like what we're doing at The Bad Roman and would like to try your hand at writing, then send us an email at thebadromanpodcast@gmail.com. We're having a blast with this project, and we would love for you to join us in helping promote it. Now back to the show. So then you go on to say, of course, there remain those who are fundamentally opposed to religion. They may be agnostic or atheist and fall anywhere on the political spectrum. These people seldom stand silent when issues such as prayer in public schools or public display of religious texts arise, such as allowing the Ten Commandments to hang from municipal buildings because it offends some of them. However, this understanding of the separation of church and state is also flawed. Now, let's talk about that. I want you to talk about that a little bit, because I think people don't understand what the separation of church and state actually means. What does it mean to you?
Well, for me, it's that the basic belief system that somebody has, whether they believe in Catholicism or they believe in Protestantism, or they're a Latter-day Saint, or they're a Hindu, or they're a Muslim, any of that kind of stuff, they're going to have this own kind of faith tenets. Most of modern Christianity and what they call the Judeo-Christian systems, you know, they can root back to the basic Ten Commandments, right? And we talked a little bit before about how the Ten Commandments, half of those commandments are basically, you know, don't hurt other people. You don't steal from them. Don't kill them. Things of that nature. So those laws make sense, but when it comes to believing in God, which God are you talking about, right? I mean, you and I might sit there and agree that there's only one God, but if you talk to a Muslim, if you talk to a Hindu, they would disagree as to which God we're referring to. So for the government to come in and say, well, you're only allowed to worship this God, that would be a gross intrusion in my opinion. Like, we should have the freedom to worship as we see fit. Whatever God, you know, some of you atheists out there might laugh at the Christians, say, you guys believe in a spaghetti monster in the sky. Okay, well, we can have a theological discussion, but I should have the right to worship the spaghetti monster, and you should have the right to worship nothing. So as long as, like, we're both living in this world and we're not hurting each other, what difference does it make what we believe? I think that's the start of separation of church and state.
My most basic understanding of separation of church and state, and it has evolved the longer this project has gone, but especially since I started studying the early church some, but my basic understanding of it is when people want to be allowed to pray in school. Okay, let's just use that as an example. especially the left, will throw this out there. No, that's separation of church and state. Well, that's not what that means to me. Separation of church and state actually means to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, it means that the state cannot dictate who we worship or how we worship. That's it. It's as simple as that to me. Now, when I said it, my understanding has evolved over, you know, since we started this project, is it means that the church, the followers of Christ, are to be completely separate from the state, period, in all aspects. Shouldn't be running for office. We should not be promoting politicians. There was nothing about the life of Jesus that shows that he tried to work through the state to get his message out there. And he left that up to us when he went to be with the Father. We should be acting the same manner as Jesus was. If you look at the early church, they did. I mean, prior to Constantine, they had nothing to do with the state. They didn't want anything to do with it. It wasn't their thing. Brexit Cavey said something brilliant to me, and it stays in the back of my head. When I had him on, he said, the state's going to do state stuff. The state is a thing. He said, but it's not my thing. He said, we may have some very strong opinions about what the state's doing. And, you know, as anarchists, we're going to have strong opinions about what the state's doing, obviously. But as Christians, it's not our thing. And I think when Christians get so wrapped up in that garbage, they lose sight of what Jesus was trying to get across to people. Love your neighbor. Love your enemy. Help those that are in need. Now, going back to what we were talking about earlier, like theology debates, I stay out of them. I don't even want to talk about it. I don't engage in them anymore because they're way over my head, and I keep it very simple. What did Jesus say? He said, love your neighbor, love your enemy. And I just keep it as basic as I can with that, because all that other stuff is just stuff to me, man. I just don't understand it. I think it causes discontent among Christians when it shouldn't. It was never meant to do that. And I mean, how many different denominations do we have in this country? Thousands. And like you said, people are going to interpret the Bible 1,000 different ways. Well, okay. That's what's happening. That's why we have all these different denominations. But if we just got back to like the Jesus-centric mindset of the early church, they followed the teachings of Christ. And the teachings of Christ, nothing about the teachings of Christ said, get your favorite politician elected so we can legislate morality. No, morality comes from following Christ, loving your neighbor, loving your enemy, not putting kids in cages at the border. That's a hot topic again, you know, every time, but, you know, nothing's changed. They're still putting kids in cages.
Yeah, I think that once you start diving into the challenge that we have in the United States system of government, you're asking a huge thing to unravel everything. You know, I have this conversation with my wife all the time. Where I don't like political parties is they always have their own agenda. They want to tackle this issue, or they want to tackle that issue. Right? The Democrats want to tackle this. The Republicans want to tackle that. Even the Libertarian Party has certain issues that they want to go for. And one issue is connected to another issue, which is connected to another issue, which is like three or four other issues connected to it. And so the reason why political parties are such a travesty in this country is that you can't solve any issues, because you're going to have to tear the whole thing down if you want to do that. And every single 4 years, we vote on a president, right? And we're either looking at a 39.8% tax rate, or we're looking at a 41% tax rate. And that's what they fight about, because they're not going to get rid of the tax system. Because if they get rid of that, then they're going to get rid of three other systems out there. So for you to be completely separated from the state apparatus, you know, it's a different kind of lifestyle. It's a different mindset. Now, because of tradition and because of history and because of how entwined people are to this system, you're asking a huge thing when you ask people to just separate themselves from the system entirely and follow the gospel. So I do recommend people listen to your podcast more for that reason, but it's not really an easy thing to do.
No, absolutely not. I mean, I still struggle with it myself. I mean, man, I spent 20 years, good 20 years entangled with all that garbage, and it's not something you can walk away from. I mean, I don't pay as much attention to it anymore. Like when there's presidential debates, I'd rather watch wrestling. It's more reality to me than a presidential debate. So I don't get all worked up about that stuff. I don't watch mainstream media. But I still have a sense to where I need to kind of know what's going on. Like when the Capitol was, when people stormed the Capitol, when all that stuff was going on, I woke up to some messages about it I didn't really know what was going on. So I kind of scrolled through Facebook to check some stuff out. I hate the news, mainstream media, but I did turn it on to see what was going on. I watched it for about 5 minutes. I turned it off and I rolled over and went back to sleep because it didn't surprise me. Nothing about what was happening that day surprised me. We should expect that at this point, because it's all theater. And we should expect this stuff to be going on because you had a certain group. If I understand it correctly, there was a certain group of people trying to keep their guy in charge or their master in charge. That's all it looked like to me. And it's the same thing as going to a poll. I mean, I don't know. People died, but it's people died because people go and vote, in my opinion, too. So I don't see any difference. I don't see any difference in that at all. Anything you want to add to that? Because I want to move to something else in your article, and then I want to talk to you about Invictus Mind.
Well, I mean, the basic idea of separation of church and state, I think you hit the nail on the head. As much as people can be aware of their personal choices and the people that they're supporting politically, look, I can tell people not to vote. I'm not a voter, and it's probably the best situation. But one of my mentors always says you have to play in the sandbox that we're in right now. And so we have a system where they basically indoctrinate you to vote. So if you're going to do that, then you might as well learn the most you can about that person that you're going to vote for. I would say start at the local level because the ones in your community, your township, they're not going overseas and killing people, right? They're basically saying, okay, should we put a red light, a stoplight in this city, or should we build a park, or should we do things like that? So if you keep your voting at the local level, then I don't see there's much danger in that. Now, we can get into a longer discussion about, you know, whether they're stealing our money on the local level or not. Sure. But, you know, when you start jumping to senators and to presidents and things of that nature, then you're getting into this convoluted situation where they're trying to represent 330 million people and saying whose idea is the best and what are our Americans' interests. And that's when you start getting warfare and immigration policies and all that kind of stuff. So for me, being an anarchist is about as separate as I can possibly be because, you know what, I don't think that anybody in the Congress, my representative I never talked to my state representatives. I know who my senators are, but they don't know who I am. And the president, it doesn't matter if it's Biden or Trump or Obama or anything, they're going to do what they got to do. But I can't control what they're going to do, so I might as well just stay out of it. Right? I don't want to support the stupid things that they're going to do because other people mandate that they do this. It's just a nightmare to me. So for me, my conscience will say, I'm going to see what's going on in my neighborhood. If there's something that needs to be done, perhaps something that needs to be voted for, you know, that's neither here nor there, but I'm going to pay attention at the local level before I ever pay attention to what's going on at the federal level.
I'm going to take some heat for this. When I say this, if a person still feels the need to vote, and I say this all the time, if you still feel the need to vote, vote for a third party candidate. I don't care if it's Libertarian, Constitution Party, or whatever, whoever. But if you feel like you need to participate, vote for somebody like that and get away from the duopoly. But I don't encourage voting. I'm not encouraged voting by saying that. The reason I tell people that is because it's kind of how I got to where I was at, is I got away from the duopoly and started seeking out a third party. And then now I'm an anarchist. And I think when you start getting away from, you realize how voting doesn't matter anyway, then you can kind of be like, all right, then what am I doing? And like you said, you don't want to be a part of it. You don't want to be complicit in what's going on either. I think if a person voting for, especially the two, the Democrat or Republican, you're complicit. And everything that they're doing, you know what they're going to do. They say a lot of things on the campaign trail, then they don't follow through. And we know this. History's proven it. So why would you want to be complicit in that, especially as a Christian? Now, we can talk as an anarchist, it's one thing, but as a Christian, it makes absolutely no sense to me to participate in it whatsoever.
Right. At this point, the federal government is so large. And you can use the word evil all you want. Oh. Yes, it is. And
I don't even know if evil describes what they're doing now. Man. There's got to be another word for it.
Right. But I have literally no say in what country the United States is going to bomb next. I have no say in that. So why would I even want to participate in a system like that? That's I think you and I agree on that right there. So,
well, the representatives in Congress, they don't have a spine to try and stop any of this. They pay lip service to it some, but then it's the same thing happens over and over and over. They're all cowards, in my opinion. They're all liars. They're all thieves. They're all murderers. They're all complicit in it. And I don't understand how anybody, especially as a Christian, can get on board with that stuff anymore. All right. We could go down a whole rabbit trail with that. Let's. You said something about George Washington. You said in your article, you mentioned a letter that George Washington wrote, a letter to a Hebrew congregation where he said, "Everyone shall sit in safety under his own vine and fig tree, and there should be none to make him afraid." Do you believe that to be true today?
Do I believe that we live in a situation where none are afraid? I don't believe that. I think at this point in time, many people are afraid. But basically, that what Washington was saying is like, listen, you guys are Hebrews, and you can believe in, you know, Judaism, and you can believe in Yahweh, and, you know, I don't even remember if George Washington was a Christian. I don't think he. I think he was also a deist. But he's like, listen, we're going to live peacefully together under the same banner called the United States, and you guys have your congregation, and you not have to worry about any government coming in and saying you can't worship that way. I really think that's what that conversation was.
Okay. And there's one last thing in your article. This kind of goes back to what we were talking about a little bit ago. It says, it goes without dispute that many atrocities throughout the history of the world have been committed in the name of religion. Much suffering has been realized in the name of God by the subjects of kings, magistrates, presidents, and worldly authorities who have exploited religion to conquer and pillage. That's still happening. That is still happening today. And I don't see that it's going to stop at any point as long as there's a state. I don't believe that we're going to see the state fall in our lifetime. But I don't believe if the state did fall that there would be chaos either. I think people would kind of, we would figure it out on our own.
Well, if you compare what's going on in the United States of America and you look at what happened with the Roman Empire, which was, well, the British Empire was in between the two. But if you look at the fall of any one of those empires, specifically the Roman Empire, you'll see the debasement of currency. You'll see the lack of morality among the people. Not that there was anything law-wise with morality. What I'm saying, just a basic individual morality of the people and a debasement of currency. And then, of course, overreaching government trying to expand to other countries and grow the empire. All those things are parallel from the Roman Empire and its fall to what's going on in the United States of America right now. We have basic immoral people. Again, you can point to whatever you decide is immoral, but I think generally speaking, people have lost faith. People stop going to church in this country. People stop believing in God. And there's all kinds of different practices out there that, you know, you could say, well, that's immoral. That's immoral. And I think just, and then of course, the debasement and printing of money, the fall is going to be great of the United Empire, you know, the United States Empire. And it was the same as what happened in the Roman Empire. So, we may not see a total downfall of any kind of government. I don't think we're going to have an anarchist society in our lifetimes. We're going to have something. But I think it's going to be catastrophic when this empire, as we know it, falls. And I can't foreshadow what's going to happen or when it's going to happen. But we saw what happened to other empires in world history. And the United States is just the same thing. The same thing that happened to all those empires is going to happen here.
Right. And I tell people that all the time, too. The people that are putting so much faith in the United States government and getting so up in arms about it that you do understand that this is going to fall at some point. It cannot sustain itself, especially the rate it's going. And they just kind of look at you out of the side of their eye like you're crazy. But and I'm like, you ought to think about preparing for a different path instead of trying to put your faith in them, because it's going to happen at some point. It may not happen in your lifetime. But think about what you're leaving to your children and their children and so on and so on, because it's going to happen. And it may happen to your child. It may happen to their child when it happens. So we need to start looking at a different direction. And I always go back to that direction being Jesus Christ, especially as Christians. Just get back on that path and let's follow what Jesus teaches, and we will be a whole lot better off. But that was an awesome article, man. Like I said, it was it got some good feedback. And if y'all haven't read it, go to thebadroman.com and check it out. Michael, before I let you go, tell us about Invictus Mind. First of all, I want to ask you, what made you want to do a podcast? Why? What crazy thought in your head thought you needed to do out there and do a podcast? Because when I started this, I just had a lot of things to say. I didn't know what a direction I wanted to go. And it just kind of fell on me one night that because I was getting so fed up with the entanglement of the Christian with the state. And I was like, this is what we're going to do. This is how we're going to go about it. But what made you want to put yourself out there like you have?
Well, you know, I got to be honest. You have much more of a focused niche, as they say, in your podcast than I do. Mine is much more broad topic. The Invictus Mind is what I tell people is we want to talk about freedom and empowerment of the individual. But when I say freedom, I mean political freedom, which, you know, we can talk about separation of state and everything like that. And I also want to talk about financial freedom. I have several years experience in the financial industry, helping people get out of debt and be free financially. And of course, spiritual freedom is your ability to pray as you see fit. So the word Invictus, it's an ancient Greek word. It really means unconquerable. I saw that word in a movie several years ago. There was a poem that came out in the late 19th century, and the author had tuberculosis, and he was just like, he wrote this poem because he saw himself as, no matter what challenge comes my way, I have the mindset to get over it because my oppression is only in my mind. And I think that that carries true to today's world too. And so when I say Invictus Mind, I want to help people understand that they have the power to make change within themselves. I started a podcast because I listen to a lot of podcasts. I've been doing sales calls for a number of years, and I would be putting a podcast on. Or I would just, one of my side hustles that I do is sometimes I do DoorDash or whatnot, and I'm just driving around. And if I'm spending time in my car, I'm always going to be educating myself. So I figure, well, I like podcasts. I learn a lot, and I agree with a lot of what they're saying. Plus, anybody who knows me personally knows that I have a lot to say in all kinds of topics. So if you catch me on a good day, you know, I'll debate with you for, you know, 3 hours. But the way when I set up my podcast, I found that I have a challenge of just ranting by myself. Like some podcasters can sit just talking to a microphone for an hour at a time. I really don't do that very well. So I always want to find somebody who's interested, or who's interesting rather, that I can have a conversation with. Like you and I are talking about spiritual freedom in a way. So I interviewed you and we talked about the same thing. That would be part of my podcast. Hey, let's figure out how to get this spiritual freedom in our lives. Let's talk about whether you're Christian. I mean, that's my belief. I haven't really talked to people outside of the Christian world, if you would. But I believe that people have a right to worship how they see fit. So if somebody's finding that they have spiritual freedom, no matter what faith they call it, then that's a good conversation for what I have, because I want them to be unconquerable in that realm. I'll talk to financial advisors. I'll talk to people who are experts in the insurance world or in debt management or investing. Give people some basic power to free themselves in the financial world. Everyone is in a system, right? We can talk about Bitcoin or cryptocurrencies and getting out of the system. We can talk about basic things like getting out of debt or how do you plan for your future so you're not enslaved by your debt. I like to talk to business owners and teach people how to control the source of their income rather than being an employee somewhere. Because when you're an employee for somebody, you don't really have time freedom. You have to go to work when they say you have to go to work. You have to ask for time off. When you're an entrepreneur or you have you're self-employed, if you own a business, then you dictate your time as that sees fit. And so that's another topic of freedom. And of course, political freedom. I am a libertarian, an anarchist by persuasion, and I like to discuss about how the Democrats, you know, want to steal your money for these things and how the Republicans want to steal your money for those things. So let's get out of those systems. So that's really the thought behind the Invictus Mind, is I want to help people empower themselves by either becoming self-reliant through their own business or becoming self-employed, how to avoid getting entangled with the state as far as religion goes, and how to just be free and independent. Because when people's thumbs are on your head and telling you where to go, when you have to work or what you have to do, that's when you really have freedom.
That's great. That's great. I do enjoy the variety that you have on your show. I've toyed with the idea of maybe branching out a little bit with ours, but I think it would take away from what we're trying to get accomplished with this project. And we do things, you know, that might be off topic, but that's okay. I mean, it gives us a little bit of variety, but it always comes back to what our main focus is. And I mean, where can we find your stuff at?
Well, I'm on all the different podcasts. I guess they call them podcatchers, right? So you can find me on Apple, on Stitcher, on Spotify. I've got my hosting through Anchor FM. So there's like 7 other places there. I put out a show every week. You'll find me on YouTube as well. I have a website called The Invictus Mind, but I got to be honest, Craig, I need to hire somebody who's good with building a website because it's lacking in many places. Eventually, I want to start having some affiliate links there and things of that nature. But you can find me on social media. I'm on all of them that exist out there and on all the podcast players.
Awesome, man. I appreciate your time and coming on to speak with us. This was a cool conversation. And thank you for contributing to our blog. It's growing slowly but surely. We're getting listeners in to contribute. We've got some in the pipeline that we haven't released yet. And it takes a little while to get them out there because we get quite a few requests. And so we get them out there when we can. I know it took a little bit to get yours out there, but we got it out there and here you are.
All right. Well, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, man. Have a good day.
Thanks for joining us this week on the Bad Roman Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the show wherever you find your podcasts to never miss an episode. And while you're at it, if you like what you heard, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes. Or if you'd simply tell a friend about the show, it really helps people find us. 100% of donations are given to local charities in Memphis, Tennessee. To learn more about the Bad Roman Project and to find show notes, please visit thebadroman.com.